So what we're going to see today is that we will introduce a new component in our system, which is caches. And when we talk about caches, then we'll also want to talk about a specific feature of these caches, which is called the MACI protocol, which is the protocol used to ensure a certain level of coherence on the systems that implement our caching strategies. So what is all about? Each of the cache lines, there's a certain state associated with it. There's four different states in our model, which correspond to different situations that our caches are in. So there's the first state, which is the invalid state. That is kind of the default state to assume in case that we don't know anything about that particular region memory yet. So we assume that the memory is at first invalid and ready to be reused in some meaningful way. Then we have a second state, which is the shared state, which means that we have information about a certain memory region, and we're not alone in having this information about memory. It is, in fact, duplicated in our system, and we share the same information with other processes. So that's the shared state. Then there's the exclusive state, which means that only this specific core, only this specific cache implementation, cache instance has information about this cache line. It's exclusive for only this cache, and no other cache actually has the same variable within. So these are two states that cannot happen in common, this shared and the exclusive. So the information about that specific memory location must be invalid in all the other caches. And then there's a kind of upgraded form of the exclusive state, which is the modified state, which means that the content is exclusive. That means it's not present in any other of the caches. And furthermore, it is also already modified in the version of this cache. So it needs to be written back to memory at some point. So these four states are the ones that are relevant for our cache lines now. And information about this status of our cache lines is communicated via message exchange. So there's also messages going around. They're sketched in the system a little bit with these arrows over there. But we can also get a little bit more in detail about the messages involved there. You can find information about these in the literature. However, I've compiled the most meaningful for us here. So there's the message read. This is the message sent from a certain CPU in case that it needs to read from a certain address that it has no information about. This is one of the messages that's going around the bus of our system. Then there's the read response, which is the answer to the upper one, and it carries the actual data which was requested by the read message. Then, in case that I want to modify my cache line, then I need to inform the other cache lines about that the value that they so far stored for that cache line is invalid now, so I need a message to invalidate. So that's this one. The invalidation needs to be acknowledged in order to proceed, so there's also the answer for that. That's the invalidate acknowledge. then there's also a certain combined message, which is this read invalidate. Why would I need something like a read invalidate? Well, the idea is that I need to, in real systems at least, I need to get my cache line before I can start to write into it. You might ask, when I want to write it anyway, why should I bother to fetch it first? Well, in real systems, this cache lines might be larger than the value that you are actually interested in. So in order to write just a fraction of it, you nevertheless need the whole cache line. So what you issue first is a read message in order to get the actual content of the whole system, and then only you can you know what the rest of the cache line should be after you have written. So that's what you need for that. And in order to do that in one piece, you have to you can resort to this message read invalidate. Then you will get the most recent content of the cache line, and in the same time invalidate this line for each of the other caches. And then there's a last message concerning the communication with the memory. In case that I have done some modifications to a certain cache line, then whenever it is requested by any other processor, then the answer will probably not be a read response, but instead a write back in order to notify the memory that it needs to put the value that then goes goes as attachment to this message back to the memory. And yeah, so the memory is one of the partners that also listens to the same bus as all the processing units. So that's why we need this write back message. Okay, so let's have a look at an example in order to get a little bit of a feeling how these messages are actually exchanged between the different processes and what situations can arise that are interesting for us. So we'll restrict ourselves to a very, very small example here, so we know that already from last time. There's the first thread, which just writes a few data into variables, and then there's the second thread, which then acts upon observing that the second variable has changed, and then tries to make sure that the first value has also changed so far. So yeah, there will be a lot of diagrams following on the next pages that try to model different situations in these caches, and we will do them all with this example, or these two codes that we see here. And if not declared otherwise, then you can assume that the initial values of the variables are zero and reside in different cache lines. Of course, if we state it otherwise, then we make an exception to that rule, like we will do on the next slide. But anyway, in principle, it you can assume this situation. Yeah, you also will see different cache line states and values, and the notation we use for that is the first letter for each of the states together with the actual value that we see at a certain cache line. So we will write M3 if our cache line will have the content 3 and the state modified. So that is our abbreviation for the whole system. And for invalid, we don't need any value, so we can just write I for invalid. So that's for the notation. So let's have a look at a typical example how the whole system works. And in this case, we will start up from a very fresh cache state for each of the CPUs. So you will see different things that can have states. There's the CPU A with cache lines for A and B. Same for CPU B. There's also the memory holding the long-term storage for these variables. And in this example, we will emanate from the situation where none of the caches has any information about the variables. Instead, they're kept in the main memory in RAM. So what's happening in these systems? Let's have a look at how thread A performs. So thread A starts with the first instruction, A.1. So in order to write into this specific location, what does it need to do? Well, for the moment, we don't have any information in A about the content, so it's invalid. So what we need to issue, what then is issued from the cache is another message. It is, will be a read, because we need to know about the cache lines, and at the same time we want to invalidate the cache line for the rest of the caches, because we need to modify this situation. So this is the message that is issued on the bus. And what we will get from our peer, which is CPU B, will be an acknowledged invalidation message. So invalidate acknowledged. And also we will get the answer about the actual content of our cache line, which in this case comes from main memory. So this will be the read response A is zero. So the invalidate acknowledgement has not changed anything in our states, the same as the read invalidation, so they stay the same throughout these two messages. So these are all staying the same. The first modification comes from the read response, so from the RAM, and what we will actually do is, well, it will copy the data into CPU A. However, we modify it as soon as it arrives. So what we will do is we will change this content to modified with a value 1 then, and everything else stays untouched, because there's actually nothing happening for the other cache lines or the other CPU. So now we have finished execution of the first instruction, so we will do the second one. This will set B to 1. So for that, we will then do a
Yes. Where is that read response A equal to 0 from?
Where's the read response from
A equal to 0? Because it just write A equal to 1 into the memory.
That's because we immediately do the. Listen, we ignore the payload in this case. So that's what the RAM is saying to us. But whatever the answer is, we override it immediately, because we are not interested in the actual data. Sir? Yes. The initial value is 0, and in actual systems, we would have more than one variable in our cache line, but in this case, we have designed our cache lines pretty small, so just for purpose of showing, but in principle, you would need the whole cache line with all the rest, and you would not ignore the rest, because you need to do a valid memory write, memory store operation. But in this case, we will overwrite it immediately, and we don't have anything else than just one variable in this cache line. Yeah, so it's a little bit of a simplification, but yeah, it's a little bit tedious to write whole cache lines in these tables. Okay, so then we do a read of B from CPU B. So this is this was a different thing. So it's not the action over there, but it's the first operation from B. So we will not try to write anything into variable B, but instead our scheduling has decided that this is the next thing that happens actually. So we will issue a read for B from our processor B. So that's what's scheduled next. So that's what happens here. It tries to query for the value of B, and the issuer is CPU B. And what's going to happen is, well, the state for B in B is so far invalid, so it will issue a read message on the bus. So that doesn't have any specific influence on anything, except that the following message that comes from main memory will then contain as payload the actual value for B, together well with the actual type of the message would be a read response. So what we will get from the whole system is that we will set the state for the line of B to exclusive. Why can we do that? Why are we sure that it's not shared?
Because no other CPU call answered our read request?
Exactly. The issue for the read response in this case is the main memory. So we know that no one else had the whole thing, and timing makes it impossible for the RAM, because it's much slower than the other caches to come up with the answer. So we would have gotten a read response from any of the other lines beforehand. So we are sure that we will have the value exclusively. So that's our situation for B here. So we're done with that. Now, yes, please. You mean why cache from CPU A doesn't answer this? Well, it has invalid in there, so it doesn't know the answer. So it assumes that either any of the other CPUs has the value or RAM will answer. So it just stays quiet.
So why in the second message we get, do we have an acknowledgement of an invalid by CPU?
This one? Yeah, for invalidations, then there's this the need for all the peers to give the answer acknowledged. So that's an explicit explicit condition that every one of the cache lines needs to acknowledge the invalidation. It may be that there's still a modified thing out there, and if you try to invalidate, then it needs to be written back to the main memory before you can do that. So there's in a way to make sure to have consistent data that you have invalidate acknowledgements from every one of the peers. Good. Okay. So, by chance, we will have the thread B cycle and re-query the whole thing. So, B1 is now executed once again, but now it has the value locally in the exclusive state, and it doesn't need to do anything there. So, the state remains the same without any communication on the bus. Now, let's continue with our thread A. In this case, we have already performed action A1, so we will continue with A2, which is another write this time to B, and that's now a little bit more interesting than before, because in this case there's already information about the cache line B in the system, in this case in B's cache. So what will happen is that it will act the same way that it did before. It will perform a read invalidate message, this time for B. And now it gets its read response from the other CPU, like this. So that's where the state of the whole system changes. And with a read response like this, not only there is the swap from invalid to a concrete value in our querying cache, but also in our answering cache, we at first had our state exclusive, like that. And now that we have given the information to the other core, we will have to set the information to the shared state. So that's what our state will be. And thus we will have zero in both of the cache lines, one time shared, one time, both times shared. And then the system reacts with working on the invalidation. It will send an invalidation acknowledgement from CPU B. Thus, we will switch over to invalid on the state, and our CPU A can continue with the modification, and it will go to modified. So let's continue with the system. Now back to CPU B. We'll once again try to get the most recent value for B. So what the situation is that we have modified values for A and B in CPU A. CPU B is ignorant to everything, and the RAM has outdated values. So what will happen here is B1 wants to read a certain variable, in this time, this case B. So that's what B1 is all about. This will issue a read message on the bus, which will be answered by CPU A, because CPU A has data on our variable B. And this is modified data. So what it will be sending back is information for the RAM to grasp the value and write it back to its own storage. And all the same, what will happen is CPU B will store the value as shared, as well as CPU A now, and the RAM will at some point also write down the new value for the whole system. So the write back is the answer for a read request in case that you have modified as your state. So that is what's happening over here. Instead of a read response, you write a write back. Read response is just for sharing information that is the same as the RAM has, but you're just quicker by querying another cache. Yes, I was waiting for you. Yeah, just. RAM is much, much slower than the cache, so it's just a timing thing here. It would have already prepared the answer in this case, but it's overtaken by the write back, and it also listens to the bus. And that's the bus just transfers to everyone. Everyone can read that, and in case that it reads new information, in this case even a write back, then it will be sure that there's other information out there, and in this case, it's even an explicit statement for the RAM to write something down. So it will be slower anyway, but yeah, it uses the time to also wait for the answer. Don't ask me about the real details of the electronics. I'm not a really expert on that, but that's the way we should think about that at that level. So for details, I think you should probably ask someone at Bode Chair or something. That should be the ones who know about that. I think this MESI protocol should also be something that Michael Gern teaches. Has anyone attended one of the high-performance computing lectures from there? So, a little bit. So, MESI is something that's familiar to you? Well, then, good to hear it here now. Yes, please? By the processor. There's cache controllers that should ensure that this is the protocol that's executed on the machine. Okay. Yeah. It's been a long time that I've actually heard these lectures from the hardware chair about that. I can imagine. I can remember that there have been a few slides on MESI, but I can't remember that they have been so detailed. So good to hear it here, I think. Okay. Anyway, what we had there was the write back to memory, and the resulting state was the one that we see over here. So this one. We now have the information shared, and memory also gets to know the new value for our variable. So now our thread B can continue, and what it will do is it will issue another query for A1 in this case, and yeah, you know the game. It issues a read because it has invalid state for our variable A, and we once again get back a write back from CPU A because we have as our state modified. So now we can assume that it is now communicating to the RAM what the actual change was. So the RAM also switches over to the new state, and cache A assumes that the information is now shared between the two caches, and cache B is switching over from invalid to the shared value. So that's in principle what's going on over there. I think that's what the whole run through our example would be, but in order to show a different or a situation that we haven't been able to show with this distribution of states, I have attached another possibility for executing our first statement here. And yeah, in difference to before, we had the invalid state for all of the cache lines. Now we have shared state for all of the cache lines, and what happens if you perform an update or a store on a shared state, well, what happens there? So we will do an A1, which writes to our A line. A is shared, so we will have to announce for the other caches that we will perform a change on our data. So what we will send is an invalidation message from CPU A. This will lead to CPU B receiving this thing. It will set our state for variable I to invalid, and will return the invalidate acknowledged to the bus, which will where it will be grasped from CPU A, which then sets modified to the cache line. Well, in this case, it has written one once again into the line. Well, that's a pretty silly thing there, but we could have also written 2 or whatever in there. So, yeah, it would have only then started to modify the whole thing. So that's the idea behind that. Okay, so that's pretty detailed and pretty messy, I would say. So why not apply the principles that we've devised last time? So here's kind of the payoff for our for the work that we have done last time. So now we have our happened before relation, the happened before modeling with these process diagrams, and the way to model our system with cache lines would be to duplicate the memory lines that we had before into 2 fractions, one for each of the processes. So we have cache lines for A and B for our process A, and we have cache lines for A and B for our processor B. So what I have left out here is the process for the memory. In case you would also want to model the state of the memory, you would have to add a few other lines. But yeah, that's the so that would be the memory at some point. But that's not so interesting there. That would be just a change of whether something like a write back happens. So that's the case where we would have state changes. But anyway, there's not too much going on there because we don't have any interesting states like modified, exclusive, invalid, or shared, or something. So that's not too interesting. It's more interesting to talk about the cache lines, actually. So we have a slightly different diagram here for you to not get bored. So this case, we have exceptions from our rule. We have in process A's cache the value B0 as exclusive, and in process B we have the value of A equal to 0 as exclusive. So the idea is now to wake you up a little bit and make you work by adding the states to the process lines for the cache lines. So for the initial things, I'll do myself now. So we'll have A caches B with 0 in exclusive state. So A's cache is over here. We will have for line B exclusive 0. For B, we will have the line for A exclusively 0. So what can we say about the other 2 initial states? Invalid? Why? That would be the general idea. Exclusive always means that anyone else except for the RAM has no information about me. So this case we will have invalid here and invalid there. So now we are having communication. The first thing that is executed we find over here. A is set to 0. So what happens is we will see a read invalidate message. What does that create as state changes? Is there anything changing? Yeah. So that's the overall goal. So we will have one to A, okay? But that's happening somewhere over there. Well, somewhere here. So there are steps in between where we have to think about the states of the cache lines.
Yes. The A becomes shared.
Mm-hmm. When is that the case?
When it gets after it sends the read response.
Mm-hmm. So we have shared over there and shared over there, because shared is always on both sides. And value is, well, the actual value. So it will be S0, S0. Yes, please?
And afterwards it becomes invalid because it's a read invalid date.
Mm-hmm. And now it also is signaled to the other process that it will be invalid from now on, so we will have invalid over here. And now it's your turn. That's the actual write that happens here. So we will perform the one over here. What is the new state? Sorry?
Modified?
Yes, modified. Okay, so I can remove my... No. It's bad. So I had modified one over there, invalid over there, and exclusive zero, and I think also invalid here, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. So, next thing. Process B queries for B. So, state changes over there. Is there, when's the first one happening? It becomes shared. Okay, but when?
After the read is sent.
Somewhere here?
Yes.
Yeah. Nice one. But actually, it's quite an interesting question when the exact timestamp actually is. But it can assume that the whole thing is shared as soon as it sends out the read response. So it's actually happening over there. That would be the thing. And it's shared zero over here now. Same as here, as soon as it arrives. So that's our new state there. And we can answer our query locally for the thing. Okay? So now we have the same execution once again. So now we don't clear everything. Yeah. B0 here. So now we once again have a look at our cache lines, but now we have the value already as shared over here. So we'll answer directly from our cache and do not have to do any communication on the common bus. So what is the next thing that happens? Well, it turns out to be this one over here. So process A then wants to perform the assignment to B. So changes. Yes, please.
After the invalidate acknowledgement at B, B is invalid. And there's a file, so my invalidate message.
Oh, that's a V, but yeah, it's missing. Pretty accurate. I wonder how that got into the system, because it should have been copy-paste. But it's the only invalid message out there, so probably that's why. Well spotted. Okay. I have to change that. I hope I will remember that. Anyway, so what's happening at A? So modified is the special version of exclusive. So in principle, it's correct, but you also intend to modify. So that's why. Okay. So modified and one like this. Okay, nice. So we'll terminate this operation. No, that's some kind of granularity that I wouldn't model here. So, principle, you're right. There might be a fraction of a second. I don't know how it's actually implemented in that detail. Whether the change to one just waits for the actual commit and then flips. So we. Well, it's only concurrent to a certain level, but yeah, you need to register this message, and as soon as it determines when you claim that this message has actually arrived, so yeah, it might be a fraction of a few cycles where it's still, but it turns out in the end for us it's interesting that it will be turned to modified then, but yeah. I'm not so sure about the implementation of when it actually changes on the hardware. But for protocol purposes, it's M1 then. Okay, so next thing to execute, no clear, is once again our query. We're querying all the time from B. So this time, we would like to do the same thing as last time. Answer locally, but turns out, well, we are invalid locally, so we have to perform a read message, so that's what's going to happen. Yeah. What's happening then? Mm-hmm. Shared one. And we get our extra attention thing, because we were modified and we got a read request. So in this case, we need to inform the main memory to also update its value, so we answer with a write back. And memory will observe that and put that into action. So the next thing would be, once again, to query for the assert. For that, we would like to query locally, but locally we have invalid since from the very first start, so we will send our read message. The state is modified, so yeah, same as before. We will set it to shared. This will also become shared, and we will have a write back. Okay, so that is the general thing what happens here. So now we have our events at the lines for the threads with our operation sequences. These are the green boxed things, and we have the dependencies between the events by the messages that go through our cache bus. So that's what all the fuzz was all about. So that's just the thing for at home. Okay, so next question would be, can MESI messages collide? That was something that has risen in the last few iterations of our lecture, and it's actually the case that the bus is guarded by an arbiter who coordinates the accesses to the bus. So there's, you can think of that like, well, you liked the Harry Potter example from last time, so yeah, this time it's not original. This time it's from YouTube here, so I don't know whether you've seen that. That's actually something that came from my colleague, so I had to look it up either way. So yeah, that's a quite catchy video, so check it out if you're really interested what the thing is. Well, it's just the characters that are stolen from there, so it's not directly an arbiter, and yeah, but it's used as characters for our thing. So the arbiter is the one who's keeping guard, and as long as it's not bombarded with any messages, it will do whatever it likes. So it will just do some kind of empty message. This one will be Snape, Severus Snape, but whatever he murmurs there, that's just like the void message on the bus. And then we will have our two components, the memory saying its content, and one of the CPUs who want to actually access the whole thing. And they need to contact the arbiter for that, and what it will do, it will look at the person that it wants to prefer there, which would be, of course, the memory here, and then it can deliver its message on the bus, and then it will turn to the other component, which will then issue its message, and then it will turn back again to doing its work. So yeah, that's what the arbiter does. It does some kind of, it has the kind of reign over the common bus, and everyone has to go through the arbiter, and the arbiter actually manages that there's no collision happening there, and if there is a collision, it will just override everything with its void message, and then tries to resolve the conflict there. So yeah, so much about the colliding messages. So in summary, for the cache coherence protocol MAISY, especially under the topic of sequential consistency, the MAISY protocol is actually the component of the whole system that ensures that even though you introduce several copies of your actual data, that the whole system still is well behaved, and as long as MAISY is actually executed on that, you will have sequential consistency on that system. With these caches that have MAISY, you will have a model for systems that don't act always in lockstep, but can have different speeds, and you will have some degree of parallelism. So yeah, that's what makes the whole system ensure that cache coherence is actually happening, in the sense that is the whole system will act sequentially consistent on processes with caches. So far, nothing new. It's just that we are able to kind of speed up our access a little bit by having local copies. Yes, please.
Is this protocol just assuring concurrency from some level? Because it's forcing you to do everything one step at a time at that level. So it's saying your tests can happen fine, but that's high level, so at my level I'm just going to say everything has to happen concurrently.
Yeah, it kind of creates a kind of inter-process dependencies, and that's how you make the system more sequential. Mm-hmm. But it's not done yet, so that's just the first iteration of introducing speed in our system by allowing some degree of parallelism in terms of unlocking the different steps between the iterations and just making it possible to do local queries that don't have to do anything with your with the other process. So there's some degree of parallelism happening there. But that's still not the model that modern systems actually have implemented, because, well, there's also new concepts like these out-of-order executions. And, yeah, we're going to introduce them step by step. We are starting with store buffers for out-of-order writes. So what is the problem here? With the way that Maisie is acting, as you have seen in the last section, you need to have the invalidate acknowledgements from all the other peers. So as soon as you start writing something to memory, you're depending on every other process to actually acknowledge your write access to your cache line. So you're depending on the invalidate acknowledges there. And, well, that's something that will make your system, when it acts on common variables, quite slow as soon as you write to any of these shared variables, because you need to write to the invalidation messages. So what is the idea there? The idea would be to decouple the continuation of the execution from the actual incoming invalidation acknowledgments. And just, so the idea would be, in exactly our example, that CPU A should be able to continue execution after A is set to 1 directly without waiting for any of the acknowledgments. And the goal to achieve that would be, from a kind of hardware point of view, to introduce some means to continue execution with new hardware feature, which is this store buffers. So what's actually done is that one of these writes is put into the store buffer and triggers the fetching of the catch line. And once the line has actually arrived, which is the answer to the to this read message that's issued, then we can already start with writing to that, and we're not actually limited to waiting for all the others to acknowledge that they also will invalidate the cache, because we already have the information that we need, and we can then press on to changing the thing. Yeah. So in actual implementations, this will pretty in most cases will be a queue. So there's still a kind of order in the messages issued there. And there might also be writes to the same location in the store buffer, which have not yet been completely worked on. So there might be several invalidations in that still wait there. Yeah, that's fine in terms of performance. That's quite a nice feature to not having to wait on the information that other processors have thrown away, their information about a certain cache line. But instead, we are able to still do some work. However, that's something that exhibits some problems when it comes to sequential consistency for the whole system. So there's problems in there if you do not do any checks in that. So what would that mean for our systems? Let's have a look at that. We are modeling our systems, once again, with our process diagrams. And this time we introduce new components into the whole system. There's, in this case, we now have a store buffer for our system. So let's have a look at a certain execution of the system. which, well, once again starts with writing changes to our variables. I have missed to put the initial values on there. So there's cache A contains for A as 0, and for B exclusive 0. Cache B contains for A shared 0, and for B invalid. Okay, so let's have a look at what our executions or our operations do then. So A wants to write to A. Well, can it be done locally? No, cannot, because our cache state is shared. So what we will do is, well, we will put the whole thing into our store buffer, and will depend on the store buffer executing the storage of our new value sometime later on, but we will nevertheless continue our execution. So we will put A is 0 on the store buffer, A is 1 on the store buffer, and continue. Next, now that we have terminated with our write action, although we haven't written anything to the cache yet, we can perform the next operation, which is a write to B. For the write to B, now there's a difference to the write to A, because E is exclusive for the process A. So what will happen there is we will have the whole thing going to modified. Modified, of course, with 1 now. Yeah, now let's see what process B makes of the whole thing. Process B wants to know the value for B. So what it will do is it will issue, try to answer the query locally. B is invalid for process B. So what it will do is it will do a read. This will make changes to the cache lines of A. Well, same as before, we will go to shared from now on, because we will propagate information about that to everyone else. This will also go to shared over there, and we will have to keep attention. We'll have to warn or notify the memory of the change that we made here. So the main memory will get its data, with the write back. Okay, so next thing that's going to happen is we will try to look up whether A is 1 now. And at that moment, there's no direct dependency from the write that we had happening over here to the read over there, because now we have introduced a new component in our system that was a store buffer over here. So in this case, we will try to answer this thing locally, and we see, oh, that's nice. We have shared 0 here, so we will yield 0 for the whole thing. Which will make our assertion invalid. And we might wonder, where did the update actually go? Well, that completely depends on where the scheduling will actually perform the storage. So when there's actually nothing happening on the bus anymore, then at some point the cache controller will actually decide that it's not a good idea to exchange information that we have not shared with the other ones before, by then triggering that the store here will, this A is one, will then actually be will be executed, which will lead into, well, the system issuing an invalidate message to our peer. So we will have invalid over here and have an invalidate acknowledgement going back there. And only now we will have a modified one as state for the cache line over here. So that's what's actually happening now that we have introduced our store buffers in our system. Okay. So don't get me wrong, having messages that can overtake each other is something that we introduced on purpose, because in most cases, or in many cases, it's actually something that we want to have, which is desirable in order to speed up our system. Where, the intention behind that is that we want to wait for a situation where there's nothing on the bus, so that we can make use of the empty bus at times when we're kind of the only ones interested in the bus, and then only then communicate the changes. So it's just a deferred communication of our changes. However, there's of course problematic behavior that comes from that. As soon as we have different CPUs in the systems, and what we wanted to have was a sequential consistency in our system. That's something that cannot be guaranteed anymore when we introduce such a behavior as the one with store buffers. So what is the thing that we need to do in order to make the whole system correct once again? There's a concept which is called the write barrier, which gives us a means to express that we want to now strictly wait for a certain change to happen in memory before continuing from now on. So that is something that is on systems where we have this out of order execution of writes, as we have it on, for example, the x86 CPUs, and that's something that is done with the SFENS instruction. Well, that's actually something that the concrete name may depend on the implementation of your compiler a little bit. It might vary a little bit from one compiler to the other, but you will find some kind of memory barrier or fence or something like that in all of them. But there's just no way of telling you on exactly your compiler for exactly your platform, you will find an instruction with exactly that name. But there is some kind of similar instruction for all of these, at least C compilers out there. Other systems might have other means to ensure that there's sequential consistency on your machine. Maybe there's something like a virtual machine running, which kind of guarantees you that the virtual machine is sequentially consistent, and in these cases you don't need to bother at all with these fences, but if it just just passes through all the behavior that the underlying hardware has, then you're screwed, and you will have to use kind of these instructions anyway. So that's what you have to look for: memory barriers, write barriers, fencing instructions, something like that. Okay, so what is it actually doing? It's working like it introduces marks into the store buffer, and it marks all the operations that are at that moment in the store buffer. And only when the store buffer continues no marked operation anymore, only then the system will continue. So that's what the SFence actually does. And yeah, this is something that can be used to get the sequential consistency once again. It also doesn't hurt to introduce these kinds of instructions at, for example, every location that you consider to be relevant for such a fence thing. But be careful if you put it too much into your code, then you essentially remove all the effect that such a store buffer actually has on your program, and will kind of revert back to the situation that we had before without store buffers. So in order to get any benefit from your actual hardware, from the store buffers that are actually working on your machine, you need to give the system a little bit of freedom. And that's by just using white barriers when necessary. Yeah, that's kind of a little bit of a black art, but for our example, it's still manageable. And what we need to do is we need to make sure that the store to B actually happens after the store to A. And the only way to do that is how this can be seen here. That's by introducing the SFence into the program order such that the write to B is actually happening after the store to A has terminated. So what's changing in this case? Let's have a look. We will start with cache for processor A with shared 0 for this thing, exclusive 0 for this thing, shared 0 for A, and invalid for B. So in these cases, we will have once again A trying to defer the store to the cache line for to defer the communication that there's something been changing on the hardware. So it will enter the A is 1 into our store buffer. But now the next thing that's going to happen is we will execute the SFence instruction, the store fence. And what that actually creates is it will mark all the things that are on the store buffer now, like this one, and only continue as soon as the whole system is empty. So what this will force is that before B is 1 can be observed by anyone, because only then it will be have been executed, is that the SFence must have terminated. And that's only terminating when the store buffer is completely emptied, and that incorporates that you communicate your change with invalidate and invalidate acknowledgement to all the other peers, which will then modify the cache line for A over there to invalid, and will create modified 1 in the cache for this thing, and will create a void store buffer over here, and SFence can terminate. So nothing too fancy here. We just introduce a new way to specify dependencies on the store buffer, and that will create dependencies from this one, to this one, to this one, and that was the dependency that we were actually interested in. That has been lost before, because we decoupled the actual write and invalidation dependencies from the continuation in our system, and with something like SFence, we now have means to reintroduce them once again. So that's the whole deal with SFence. Okay, good. Yes, please. Yes. Well, as always, there's several sides to that. There's also the concept of compilers reordering expressions and statements. But in that case, we want to talk about the actual fences on the store buffers, which result in something like hardware reordering and out-of-order execution on hardware. So, yeah, in principle, you could do without these S fences in that case, as long as your compiler doesn't do any reordering, or there are separate instructions for keeping compiler reorderings from hardware-driven reorderings. Okay. Yes, please. I think I have to ask more in detail. Which difference would you have expected?
That the store buffer now, okay, now you say my A equals 1, now it's temporarily stored in my store buffer. But before you do your next instruction, your B equals 1, you need to execute everything in your store buffer. So you put something in, you execute it, and it's exactly the same as if the store buffer wasn't actually there in this example.
Yeah, so yeah, we kind of undo the effect that the store buffer would have in that specific situation. But there's situations where you have common variables where you can omit to undo this thing and get an actual speed up from the whole thing. So it's just that particular situation where you're actually interested to undo that. So that was the purpose of having the yes fence here. In case that it's actually a queue, then yes. Yeah, in that case, if the situation is right, you end up with a system that in this particular sequence doesn't even need an S-fence at all because, well, in this case it would be observable in the right order once again, but yeah. We have to deal with situations like these, unluckily, so that's why we put the S-fence in there. Yeah. But you could, for example, imagine that it would be a speed up to have the store to be go into the store buffer, because that one can be deferred without any penalties. So that would be something that's fine, and we don't have an S-fence after B is written to. So in this case, there's ways where you can just wait for the bus to become available and then just then start to work on your store queue. So that would be a valid place where your S-fence isn't strictly necessary, but for A, we actually want to have this dependency, so we undo the decoupling. Good. Okay, so the next thing that's actually done in hardware is having invalidate queues in order to have out-of-order reads. So that's another thing that's happening and makes our machine model even more complicated. So we had already means for decoupling stores from actual communication on the bus. And we can now continue and also have continue our execution and also have means to undo that in case that we make our system incorrect. So now the next thing is that invalidation is something that is also costly at some point, because the invalidation of a certain variable is something that competes also with CPU accesses to your cache. So it might be inconvenient for your process to work on a lot of invalidations, especially when other processes are working on variables that you will not need at that point anyway. So there will also be an idea for improvement by decoupling the actual time where you actually perform your invalidation from the point where you receive the message. And this leads to introducing these so-called invalidate queues. So that's another component that creates a little bit of confusion in our MESI protocol and possibilities for the system to actually act in an inconsistent way. Because with these components, the invalidation messages are not directly executed anymore on your cache lines, but instead end up in an invalidation queue, and when the local CPU tries to access a certain cache line, it does not need to consider whether there is still a message for specifically that cache line still in the invalidation queue. And yeah, that's something that looks a little bit confusing, especially when you have to make sure that everything is sequentially consistent. So let's have a look at an example once again. So now we have another new component for our system, which is the invalidation queue that I have inserted here. Also note that I haven't added the store buffer for the process B, as well as I haven't added the process for the invalidation process line for the invalidation queue for process A, but that's because, well, we don't actually perform any invalidations or stores in the respective direction, but in principle you would have to add them. They're just not doing anything in this case, so I have omitted them. Anyway, now we have our pieces of code, like we had the last time also already, and it's also already patched with our SFence in order to make sure that we communicate the store to the other cache lines before writing to B, and thread B is still the same as before. So what are we looking at here? We have certain initial states. For process A, we have A with shared 0. We have B with exclusive 0. We have B with shared 0. No, not this one. A with shared 0 and B with invalid. Okay, so let's try to trace what's actually happening. So at first we're executing our store to A. So what we're gonna have is we will enter the thing into our store buffer. It goes to 1. Then we terminate with that thing and immediately continue with the next action, which is then the SFence, which will lead to marking the store as to still to be done before continuing. So the system will wait until there's actually something happening on the bus. And what's happening on the bus is that we will communicate our change. I'm not actually sure whether there needs to be an event. I think that's some kind of copy paste thing there, because well, what we actually do is we send out an invalidation message, which will end up here on the other side. And yeah, now we have the new component. The new component is speeding up our computation at B, and it does so by keeping the invalidation message in the invalidation queue. So what we will get there is something like, invalidate A on the queue. Then we can already send back the answer, invalidate acknowledgement. Well, that's fine here. So what we will do is we will set this thing to, well, its new value, which is modified 1, and sfence can continue. Everything's fine up till now. Then we have the next operation, which will then set B to 1. This can be done locally. So what we will do is we will set this thing as modified 1. And now what we will do here is switch over to the other process, where we have our lookup for B. The lookup for B, we'll see that locally we have invalid data, so we will issue a read. This read will, no, will make the data shared now and shared over here with 1. Also, we will communicate to memory that it can now write back its new data. So now that we know that B is 1, we now try to query A to make sure that A is also 1. And yeah, happens to be that our invalidation queue was somehow stalled or busy or whatever, and hasn't yet reached the point where it communicates back that the line for A is actually invalid. So what we get here is that A is shared 0, and yeah, once again we will have a situation where we get the non-desired thing. Why is that? Because there's still one thing missing. We have here the invalidation of A, and it happens that it arrives just a little bit late. So that is one of the possibilities that can happen. Of course, there's a lot of situations where it, everything works out just fine in case that the invalidation happens a little bit before, but it doesn't have to. There's no direct connection there that forces this thing to be triggered by the read at some point. So, similar situation as we had for the store buffers is something that we get with invalidate queues also. So, the problem is that the read accesses do not actually consult the invalidation queue, which would slow down the queries for certain variables by a lot of time. So what we might consider is that the value that we get from an ordinary terminating read instruction is an outdated value. So this is something that might bother us a little bit, especially when we think about consistency and correctness and all that. So we once again need a way to re-establish sequential consistency for these things. So the problem is that between writes of other processes and local reads, there's no actual connection anymore. And there is a way to do that, and it's quite similar as we have seen before. Once again, we need fencing. But in this case, we need another type of fence or barrier, which is the explicit read barrier. So we have something like that on x86 CPUs. And, well, at least in my compiler, it's called an elfence, but, well, that depends on your compiler, once again. That's the playing a similar role as the sfence has played for the store buffers. What it does is quite similar. It takes the invalidations and marks them. And it only continues when all the still to be executed invalidations have been processed, and only then our system continues. So the idea would be to use that in front of read instructions that are in danger of getting out of date values. Of course, it once again does not hurt to introduce them a little bit more often than they would be strictly necessary. But with each of these fence instructions, you of course insert a new dependency in that happened before diagram, and with that you reduce the possibilities for parallelism in there. And if you do your read barriers everywhere, you will end up with a sequentially consistent system, guaranteed, but it also removes the effect that your invalidation buffer had on your system. So if you're really paranoid, you can introduce fences after all of your instructions, store fences as well as load fences, but in these cases you will remove all the benefits of your modern hardware except for just your local caches. And yeah, that's probably not what all these things were about. So let's have a look at what is happening if we now introduce our newly learned instruction there. And in this case, we introduce a load fence before we touch our endangered variable, which is the A here. And yeah, we do that by inserting an L fence such that it goes into the dependencies for thread B. So what's happening? So now everything starts as it had before. So there's locally there's no difference. There was we were starting with what were we starting with? I think it was exclusive zero and shared zero. Shared zero and invalid. And we got to do an invalidation on A over here. And we did a modified one for cache line here. That was the effect of the sfence. Now we perform the store on variable B from thread A, and in this case we would come to modified one over here, and yeah, we will issue our read as we had. So we will do shared over here, and now we get our L fence, the load fence, which will lead our system to communicate the invalidation over here. So we will get invalid over here, and the L fence only then terminates when the whole thing is invalidated. We have the empty invalidation queue over here, and only now we execute the query for A1, which will now finally succeed, as we now have invalidated this thing. We will read the modified value, set it to shared, write it back, and have it shared over here, and now everything works fine. Very nice. So that's what the elfence gives you. As a summary, modern CPUs have a lot of relaxations on the strict model that we have seen last time. It's actually a weakly ordered memory model, and reads and writes are not necessarily synchronized unless the user actually actively enforces the whole system to work in a synchronized manner. We have we have means for that with our memory barriers, which are these store and load fences. My compiler, they are combined into one instruction, which is called the mFence. So that's the one that we'll probably use in practice. And the thing is that with the latest C++ standard, for example, you can declare a variable as being volatile. In this case, you will actively make the compiler insert the memory barriers at the appropriate places. So every time you use such a volatile variable, you will get the corresponding fence addresses, fence instructions set automatically. If you are not on the latest C++ standard or don't want to introduce them automatically and want more control over how much parallelism your system actually allows, in these cases you would have to, for example, resort to inline assembler or these explicit fencing instructions. So that's your lowest level of synchronization, memory barriers. We'll have an example or an application for this thing next time, I think. Anyway, we will have a look at these systems in the tutorial session on Friday. So thank you for your attention and have a nice week. We'll see you next time.